Welcome to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Writer J.M. DeMatteis is well known for his hero stories featuring Spider-Man and Batman. He's also known for the humorous twists on the Justice League, the Defenders, and currently from Boom Studios, Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade. But there's also the lyrical side of J.M.'s writing that comes through on books like the groundbreaking adult fantasy Moonshadow from Epic, The Stardust Kid from Boom Studios, and Abadazad, which went from being a dead book in the ashes of cross-gen comics to its phoenix-like rebirth as a children's book series from Hyperion. Abadazad's first two volumes debuted in June and are getting a big push from the publisher's parent company, Disney. Our conversation begins with the long publishing journey of Abadazad.
Tell me about Abadazad and your what you're trying to do in terms of recapturing the children's audience for comics.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about this now is, how much do you know about the backstory on Abadazad and what we went through to get here?
I do know that it started at CrossGen, and
yeah,
I know you
well,
were
you
very
know,
excited about
it. Really,
that.
A long time before that, because I've had this hankering for a long, long time to see some really smart, literate, beautifully illustrated comics for kids. And as we know, mainstream comics has pretty much abandoned that audience. Or, you know, if they do try, they think it means you license a few Cartoon Network shows and you throw them out there, and that's kids' comics, you know? This started back in the 80s. Stardust Kid, which I'm doing now with Mike Palou for Boom Studios, actually started as something that I sold to DC back in the 80s. And I realized after working on three issues that given the realities of the market back then, this thing would have gone out there and just disappeared. And DC, to their credit, allowed me to buy it back, and I fooled around with it for 15 years and resurrected it. But this was something that I had in mind for a long time. In fact, at one point, I was going around to several companies proposing an entire line of children's comics. What I kind of put it forth as the Vertigo line with that level of quality and the writing and the art, but for kids. Or my other line was Moonshadow without the sex and the violence. And really, no one was interested, and the big project I was pumping more than anything was Abadazad, which was a story that I had brewing in my head for a long time. And my daughter's 11 now. I've been telling her Abadazad stories practically her whole life, you know. And I cannot begin to tell you how many people didn't get it or weren't interested. And you know, that's the nature of the beast. It's not like I'm walking around grumbling in bitterness or anything. But it's just it is amazing to me that a medium that started out primarily for kids has just sort of gone, we're not interested in that. They know what they do, and they know how to sell it, and they'll keep doing it. Then I didn't know that much about CrossGen, but I'd heard they'd been around for, I guess, 2 or 3 years at that point. They seemed like they were doing well, and I took my proposal and sent it off there to Ian Feller, and within 2 days I got this enthusiastic response, and I said, yes, let's do it. Ian Feller and Mark Alessi, I'll give them all the credit in the world. You know, no matter what else happened with CrossGen down the line, they understood this property and they really were enthusiastic. And without beating a dead horse, we know that CrossGen was having some serious problems, which I didn't know when I was signing the contract, but what are you going to do? They went into the bankruptcy thing, and I also have to give them all the credit in the world because they were the ones that pulled Mike Palou into the project.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even know he was even interested in doing comics anymore, you know, and he chose this as his as the story that he wanted for his return to the medium, which is fantastic. So we're having a great time, you know, doing this project, and sometimes you work on certain things, and you just know that it's working, you know? And with Abadazad, from the first word and from the first sketch that Mike did, we knew that this was something really special. And those kind of projects, you know, only come along a few times in a career. And so we're having this wonderful creative time, but we didn't realize that we were sort of writing and drawing while standing on quicksand.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing just went down there, and we got in, you know, we had to get lawyers and trying to get the rights back and all this and that, and water under the bridge now, you know. This wonderful thing happened as all these companies started, you know, circling around CrossGen trying, who are we going to buy? Is this one going to buy? We keep hearing all these rumors. But what happened was that Brenda Bowen, who is a vice president and editor-in-chief over at Hyperion Books for Children, saw Abadazad, and she just fell in love with it and thought this would make a fantastic series of children's books. And as she tells the story, you know, she really wanted to see if she can get a hold of the property, discovered that CrossGen was going under, and this is a conversation that can only happen in a company that's owned by Disney. Someone said to her, so why don't we just buy the company? So they wanted Abadazad, and they bought a whole company, and they got all these other wonderful properties along with it.
You bet.
And, you know, there were still, you know, deals to be worked out and thing, you know, a lot of hoops to jump through for us to get a deal that we were happy with, and the deal was wonderful that we made with them. But the best part of the story was we survived, and we're getting to tell our story.
Very cool.
So I just came back yesterday from Book Expo America, you know, the big publishing event of the year.
Yes.
Which is where these books debuted. I finally got to hold the actual books in my hand. And, you know, we couldn't have landed in a better place. It was a real lesson for me that, you know, in life very often we run into these obstacles, but if we can just shift our vision a little bit, we'll see that these obstacles really end up being opportunities that are leading you someplace far better than you could have ever been. Had any of those places that turned us down bought a Bodhisattva, probably would have been canceled in 6 months because the market wouldn't have sustained it. You know,
sure.
Who knows if CrossGen could have sustained it. With all these sort of, quote, negative experiences, we ended up, you know, with this fairy tale ending. And, I walk into Book Expo, and there's, you know, one staircase covered in the Bodhisattva artwork, a giant banner hanging from the ceiling. Everyone that walks in to get their badge gets in a Bodhisattva lanyard. They're giving away posters. I mean, the power and the enthusiasm that they're putting behind this project is just amazing to me. We've got a print run of 100,000 for each book. It's the first two books are coming out simultaneously, and they're already talking about going back to press already. And it's incredibly exciting. And the best part is that we're doing it in this wonderful format, which is sort of part illustrated novel and part graphic novel. So you're reading prose with illustration that segues into comic book sequences and back to prose and illustration, and it's just been a wonderful, wonderful format to work in. So one, you know, it's somewhere between a novel and a comic book, and it's very, very cool. And the books have just turned out so beautifully. And we brought, you know, Nick Bell along with us, so he's doing the same amazing color over Plouc's pencils that he did on the comic book. And the production job that they've done at Hyperion is just, I'm so over the moon about this, I can't even begin to put it into words. So it's really exciting. And it's a great thing. I was talking to my wife about the other day. This is sort of a wonderful sort of bridge project, because I've been thinking about the comic book fans that are going to follow this into book form, but somebody pointed out to me that there are going to be a lot of kids out there that will walk into the children's book section of their Barnes & Noble and pick this up, and they've never seen a comic book before.
You bet.
And they're going to see this, and this is going to lead them, you know, back into that world. And that hadn't even occurred to me. I was talking to Karen Berger the other day, and I think she was the one that pointed that out to me. And it hadn't even occurred to me. So it's going to make this nice sort of magical bridge between straight books and the comic book world. And it's very exciting. We're planning to do 12 books. And so if all goes as it seems to be going, we'll be doing the Bodhisattva for many years to come.
That's wonderful. And I think you're right. I think that children's book format is better because you're aiming for parents. They're the ones that might be buying for kids. And you're right. I think the children's section of a bookstore is the place to go for a story that sounded like what a Bodhisattva was going to be even at CrossGen. So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And also, God, getting a guy like Plouc, it's funny. I think comic fans might remember him for a lot of his horror work.
Yeah.
But I was a big fan of the Ralph Bashke film Wizard.
Oh, he's worked on more movies than you could count.
I'm sure.
I mean, he starts rattling off all the movies he's worked on, and my brain explodes. You know?
Well, and that's the thing, and you know, as good as he was with Monsters, that's how good he is at handling fantasy. And again, if comic fans have seen things like Wizards, then all those static images are Mark Plouc artwork, and you can kind of see that the guy definitely has an eye for it.
We've been working together for 3 years, but we didn't meet face to face until last Wednesday.
Wow!
On the way to the Book Expo, because he lives in England. I'm in upstate New York, so we're on the phone all the time. But it was really a treat to finally get to meet each other face to face after all this time and all this this work creating this thing together.
Good luck, because obviously, yeah, I'm sure Disney will be watching very closely how well this does, and it'd be wonderful if any type of franchise can come out of it. I mean, I know you're thrilled with the book itself, and I'm sure you're very happy with where it's going to right now. But you know, let's shoot for the moon.
Yeah, why not? I just want to line my office with Bodhisattva action figures, and I'll be happy.
There you go.
They don't even have to sell them to anybody else. Just make them for me and get them.
So then we move on to the next age group, and the Stardust Kid.
Yeah.
So, and that's coming through Boom Studios.
Right. While we were in the midst of this legal action on Bodhisattva, and Mike and I were getting more and more depressed because we really didn't know. You know, it could have been one of those things like where the rights could have been tied up for 10 years. You know?
Sure.
Those guys from First Comics, I think last year, just started getting their rights back.
That's right.
Comics that were published in the 80s. So it was not a cheerful mood that we were in. And one day I finally said, Mike, you know, we can mope about this, or, you know, we're creative guys. Let's come up with something else. And the Stardust Kid, as I said, was a story that originally I had sold to DC back in the 80s. And I've been, every, you know, every couple of years I go back and I tinker with it and I play with it and it was sort of okay, but something was missing. And then talk about a great collaboration. I have like one probably 15-minute conversation with Mike. He gives me a little feedback and suddenly I see the story in an entirely new way. It took me 15 years to figure it out, but it took one conversation with Mike to do it. So it was a great way to take that energy and that frustration over what was going on or wasn't going on with the Bodhisattva at that moment and take it someplace new. And it's also an all-ages fantasy, very different from a Bodhisattva in terms of what the story does, but in terms of what we're hoping to bring to it and what we hope children and their parents will get out of it. I think it's similar in that way. So we took it to boom, and unfortunately, because of everything that's going on with the Bodhisattva stuff, it slowed us down a little bit. You know, changing companies slowed us down, working on the Bodhisattva slowed us down. So issue number 4 will be out, I just found out today, will be out June 21st. I just got the word from Ross Ritchie. And then we're trying to finish up the 5th issue while we're working on the Bodhisattva stuff, so we may not see the 5th issue till the fall sometime. And then Ross wants to do a really nice collection next winter.
Is it only going to be 5 issues, or is it going to be 6?
It's a 5-issue miniseries.
Okay.
We at the moment, we don't have the time to do more. These books have turned into much more work than we ever anticipated, which is not a bad thing. But
absolutely
not. Planning.
And it seems like with projects like The Stardust Kid and Brooklyn Dreams, too, the teenage experience seems to be an area that you like to get back to in your storytelling.
Yeah. You know, people have brought this up to me before. My wife's answered that question. Is she thinks I'm emotionally stuck at 17. but I think there's truth in that up to the core. I think all of us, I don't mean completely stuck. I think I've moved on somewhat. But I think all of us have a certain point in our life where some emotional issue or something holds a part of our brain or a part of our soul there, you know? And I still very much understand and relate to that point of life, because I think it's a hugely important point of life. You know, for me, it was one of the biggest transformations of my life came at that age. And so when I sit down to deal with a Cody and the Stardust Kid or Kate and the Bodhisattva or something that's, you know, more directly autobiographical like Brooklyn Dreams, I'm there, you know, and I understand that. Because it's such a time of transformation.
Sure.
One minute you're like, you're a kid, you're sort of a dumb, naive, innocent, sweet kid, and then all of a sudden your hormones start exploding. And it really is. It is like a fantasy story. It's like watching something morph in a movie, you know?
You bet.
I have these pictures of myself from like ninth grade graduation and watching my body, my arms are like down to my toes and my ears are too big for my head and my body is like, you know, you can practically see it growing and changing in the photo, you know? And then all these emotions, and it's like, and the, you know, the metaphor in The Stardust Kid is all these creatures that are wrapped up in these cocoons becoming something else. And that's really what it's like. You're becoming this completely other thing, and you're questioning everything about your life. And it's, for me, it was the first time I really was asking the deep questions about, you know, what is this all about? Why am I here? What is the point of all this, you know? So it's a great place to return to. And I think in life, we really tend to cycle through that. Hopefully, if we're living our lives with our eyes open, there will always be points in our lives where we go back and we question and we sort of tear down the structures that came before and then move on. But the teenage metaphor has just worked so beautifully for those changes in all of life. So I think that's why I go back to it.
And at Marvel, it seems that's kind of the kernel of most of the stories, is the teenage experience and that feeling of being an outsider and adapting to a new situation.
Right, that certainly has been the engine that fueled the X-Men for many years. Even though some of the characters seem like they must be 40 years old or something.
Well, yeah,
still,
yeah. Or even the Hulk.
Teenage metaphor at work, you know?
And even the Hulk as well.
Yeah.
You know, kind
yeah,
of.
True.
So, yeah, I'd add Spider-Man, of course, yeah. So.
Yeah.
It always seems to come back.
I never thought about that, but that's very true. And, you know, young adult fiction is certainly mines that. And look, you know, the Harry Potter books, and you watch Harry's evolution from book to book. You know?
You bet.
So, yeah, but, you know, the real fun of this for me, though, is this really like a Bodhisattva started and Stardust Kid started when my son was little. And I wanted comics that I could read to my kids. There's not a lot of them out there, and I wanted something with some nurturing, rich, literary and artistic content, you know. And the fun for my daughter with both of these projects has been, you know, watching them evolve, you know, from stories that I told her to an actual comic book and now a book, and then seeing the Stardust Kid. My poor son's been waiting since the 80s for the Stardust Kid. You know? He's not a little boy anymore, you know. But it's been great. And writing for that audience is so important to me. It's just so important to me. You know, I've done I've done the dark stuff. I've done the, quote, adult stuff. But it nurtures me as much as it nurtures the reader to write these stories. You know, it's really great.
And it's cool because I think there's a lyric quality to these stories that you write. And I would throw Moonshadow, although it's an adult story, in
that
as well.
Yeah, well, you know, Moonshadow, if you remember when it came out, the tagline was a fairy tale for grown-ups. And that's why when I was pitching these kids' comics, I said, you know, Moonshadow without the sex and violence. Because even though Moonshadow dealt with very adult subjects, it dealt with it as if it was a fairy tale.
Yes.
And with John J. Muth's incredible artwork, you know, it really looked like a kid's picture book. And so, yeah, there's a definite connection that takes all these projects and puts them in a row and connects them up, even though one might be for so-called adults and others might be for so-called kids.
Have you ever talked to somebody like Neil Gaiman? Because it's funny, you know, that year of 1985, and that was really even before Gaiman had really come on the scene.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, Moore's Watchmen, Dark Knight, Mouse. Those are the ones that people seem to remember. But I remember Moonshadow, and it was during the direct market as well. At least in Chicago, it seemed that's when the direct market was exploding for me. And it was books like Moonshadow and those three that really was like, wow, comics are really going into interesting directions.
It was an incredibly exciting time to be in the comic business. It was amazing because suddenly all these barriers were just dissolving. Subject matter, all kinds of material, whatever you know, as much as you could let your imagination go, you could do it if you wanted to.
Yes.
Know? No one came to me and said, "Why don't you expand yourself as a writer and go write Moonshadow?" I just had to write it. I remember sort of looking around and seeing the first glimmers of the shift. You know, I remember DC did, was it Camelot 3000?
Yes.
The Mike Barr thing, which I think was the first maxi series, and these new formats were, you know, the Epic line was just starting up. And I thought, well, you know, it's fun over here writing whatever it was, Captain America, The Defenders, but I gotta write something that really matters to me, to the depths of my soul, you know. And what it did for me as a writer was it allowed me to step outside of the Marvel and DC universes and just write. Suddenly, my brain was not writing comic books; it was just writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be matched up with an illustrator of the quality of John J. Muth, you know. Also, I mean. We fed each other, you know.
Yes.
In the very, very beginning when I was working on it, I had a certain sort of image in my head of how I wanted it to be and what the story was. And Jay showed up in my house one day with the initial sketches, and they had this incredibly Dickensian feeling to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I looked at those pictures that I realized, oh, that's what I created. And I didn't even realize it. This is totally a Dickensian story, you know.
Wow.
And so looking at reacting to his work helped me find the voice for that story, and I think my story pushed him to do things that he normally wouldn't do in his work, and I think both of us reached new levels in our craft, I could even say art, because I think it was a work of art, that series, you know.
I completely agree, and I think you find the right artists for these projects that add to the lyric quality of the stories themselves.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, this, I was talking to somebody about this very thing the other day, too. You can have the greatest script on earth and the most phenomenal art, and if there's not that chemistry, that magic thing that happens between writer and artist, it doesn't matter how good the script is or how good the art is, it's going to lay there.
Yep.
And there's no way to predict, you know, if I would have done Moonshadow with somebody other than Muth, if I would have done Abadazad with somebody other than Ploog, I could have written it, every word would have been the same, every beat and every panel would have been the same, and it wouldn't have been the same. And that's the amazing thing about working in comics. It's like music, too. You know,
yes.
You get together and you play music with people, and with somebody it's not going to work, and then suddenly, you know, four guys get in a room and it's magic.
Did these stories feel more simpatico with trying to write songs? Do you,
you
even
know, it's interesting. I think about that, because music for me, what's fun about music for me is that it tends to flow more easily. When you pick up a guitar, sit at the piano, and write a song and sing, it just sort of flows out of the deeps. And even if I work, I write a lot of songs, and even if I work on a song over the course of days, it rarely feels like pulling teeth. It's just a flow. It's just sort of tuning into a flow. And singing, you know, singing is just, you go into that magical deep part of yourself, and it just comes out. You know, you're not thinking about it. You're not crafting it. You're not. Whereas stories, for the most part, the dreaming part is great. The dreaming part of stories is like music. Because the best part of my job is I lay on the floor of my office staring into space, you know, drooling, and watch movies in my head.
Sure.
That's really fun. That's the best part, you know. And suddenly a story takes shape, and you watch things happen, and it's just magical. And then the hard part is trying to, you know, if I could just sort of sing that from my brain, you know, I never thought about it that way. If I could take what I'm seeing in my head and sing it as opposed to having to write it, boy, I think it'd be great. Maybe it's time to write an opera or something, I don't know. But then when you sit down, you know, sometimes there are magical times where you sit down to write something and it's like this wave comes along and you get your surfboard and you just jump on and you balance there and you don't have to do anything. You just ride the wave and it's magical. But more often than not, it's hard work. And there's an old line of Dorothy Parker's, and it's going to make me sound more literary than I am because I actually heard it years ago on an episode of The Odd Couple. But the line is, I hate writing, but love having written. And it's a great line. And there's a lot of truth in that. I love the dreaming of the story. I love, you know, with a Bodhisat, I really feel like somewhere on some other dimensional plane, there isn't a Bodhisat, and they're beaming this information into my head, you know?
Sure.
And so opening up my head and seeing the movies and watching it come through, that's great. But it's getting that information down in the right way. But sometimes it's very magical, and I've told this story before, but it continues to amaze me. When I was working on the third issue of Abadazad, now I had worked out, I knew what all the characters were, I had the arc of the storyline worked out, I had everything set, every character was nailed down. So I sit down to write one day, and I type the first line, and there's a character there that I have never heard of before. Until I typed his name, I had no clue, and I'm thinking, well, who the hell is this, and what are you doing in my story, you know? So I write this little section of the story, but I know I've got this issue all worked out, and I have all these other characters that have to come in and do this. So I'm trying to write the first half of the book, and it is just abysmal. It's just horrible, and it's agony for days. And then I get the sense, okay, well, this new character, whoever he is, he wants to be in the story. I said, oh, just wait a minute. Just let me finish the first half of the book, and I'll put you in the story. And the first half of the book, forget it, it dies. And I realize, okay, he wants to be in the first half of the book. Not only does he want to be in the first half of the book, he wants to be in the first couple of pages. And once I got this character, who I had never heard of before, into the story, then the story flowed. So explain it to me. Am I writing these stories? I don't know who's writing these stories. This character appeared on the page and told me I better be in this book. And he turned out to be this character, Master Wicks, who's incredibly important to the series, you know, to the whole series. And I didn't have a clue. That's when writing is really fun. When you feel like you're channeling something that has almost nothing to do with you, and what you do is you have to serve that story. You know, the story's not serving you. You have to serve that story, and that's when the magic happens.
Is there a circle of fantasy writers that you are aware of? Like, and I started to ask about a guy like Neil Gaiman, for example, but are there other comic writers or any circle of writers that you know that you've discussed the process of writing stories like Abadazad and Stardust Kid?
No, not really. You know, it's funny. Because of the nature of what we do and there's so much working with illustrators, I probably spend more time talking to artists than I do talking to other writers. So yeah, it's a funny thing. Now that you mention it, very rarely am I sitting around hanging around with other writers to talk about the art and craft of writing.
Okay.
Actually, most of my time is spent alone in a room, staring into space.
Sure.
Who am I going to talk to?
Well, and I know with Giffen, and I know you've said before in other interviews, and you've talked a lot about Justice League, and I know that you're proud of Justice League as well.
Oh, totally.
But I know that, yeah, it started with, you know, Giffen kind of plotting, and then you adding your dialogue and kind of going back and forth.
Terrible, I totally forgot about Keith. Keith is the one writer that I do talk to. But we talk, our conversations end up being vaudeville routines. I don't know if we talk about art or craft very much, you know. But it is true, when we worked on Justice League, Keith basically would lay down the plot. They would send it to me. 99% of the time I would have no clue what was in the plot till I saw it. And then, you know, that's where it really was like music. Because it's like Keith has got the drums and the bass going. And I start playing a guitar line over that, you know, or a piano fill or something. And so I would just start riffing over what Keith did, and then Andy Helfer would come in and sort of clean everything up, because Keith, you know, Keith is a maniac, and the things that he throws in, and I would write so much that the word balloons couldn't fit on the pages, and Andy would clean it all up, and we'd have a comic book. You know? And the difference now with what we're doing now with Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade is that there's a lot more conversation beforehand, because these are characters that we've created together. So we'll talk the stories through and figure out where we want the storylines to go. But the beauty of it is, still, we'll talk it through, and then Keith will sit down to do the plot, and maybe he'll do what we talked about, or maybe he'll be in a different mood that day, and he'll do something completely different, you know? And then he'll throw it to me, and off I'll go again and change everything on him, and then he'll change it on me. And that's really the fun of our collaboration, is that, you know, we're both totally free even though we're working as a team, we're also totally free to work independently. Now, I've dialogued other people's work over the years. In a normal situation in comics, if you come in and totally, totally change someone else's story, they're not going to want to work with you again. But that's been the key to what Keith and I do, is that freedom to play. You know, I've always likened it to a game of tennis. You know, he bangs the ball over in my direction. You know, I bang it back, and it builds. It builds that way. And we're actually having more fun now than we had back in the 80s. Because back then, it was a job. You know, Andy Helfer hired Keith. Andy Helfer hired me. So God bless Andy. He saw something that no one else could. Who would have ever thought of putting the two of us together, you know? And it was a great job, but it was just a job. And then we didn't really work together for 10 years after that. And then formerly known as the Justice League came up. And when we started working on that, we both kind of went, oh, this is really fun. No, it took that 10-year gap for us to realize that when we work together, something special happens.
And now that
we figured it out, we're going to beat this into the ground until they don't want us anymore. You know? So with Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade, we're having a fantastic time.
Terrific. And I was pleased as well with the Marvel run that you guys had on the Defenders
Well. Defenders, yeah, that was a lot of fun as well. What's fun about Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade is that this is ours, and we're getting to create a whole universe of ridiculous Given to Matt's character.
Yeah, Keith mentioned one of them, and I think it was the one that maybe didn't get through, and it had something to do with a part of the female anatomy.
Oh, yeah, since the time we started this, Keith has been like, pubic justice, we're going to do pubic justice.
Yes,
and my job is to say, that's very nice, Keith, and never put it in the script.
Well, Hero Squared is great, and I did read the first issue of Planetary Brigade. Is the second issue out yet?
Oh, yeah. It came out a couple months ago.
Oh, okay, good. I have to find it now, because Hero Squared is eventually going to be an ongoing, correct?
It's starting, I think it's coming out at the end of this month, yeah. At the end of this month, issue one of the Hero Squared ongoing and the trade paperback that collects all the previous Hero Squared material will be out.
Very cool.
And in the back of the Hero Squared trade paperback is an expose on the secret life of Giffen and Demetis.
You'll
hear the entire story, the true shocking story of our partnership and how it really happened.
That's very cool. Well, we'll look forward to that. Boom seems to be a great place for both of you guys, where you're able to not only work together, but a lot of independent projects as well.
Yeah. Boom has been, from the very start, just a fantastic place to be. And it's because Boom basically translates into Ross Ritchie. You should talk. I don't know if you have you ever interviewed Ross?
Not yet, no.
You should talk to Ross, because he's something. He is an incredibly smart and creative guy, but the most important thing to me, he's also a truly honest and honorable guy. And you know, when you deal with Ross, everything is straight.
That's cool.
And he's not looking to make $1 million. He's not looking to take over the market. He's just looking to do some quality work and get it out there, and he wants everybody involved to have a good time. Can't ask for anything more.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Very cool, and yeah, looking forward to more of both Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade. But I want to reach back a little bit and talk about, and again, I want to point everyone out, because, it's like, how come you're not talking that much about Justice League? How come you're not talking about Spider-Man and Kraven's Last Hunt? One of the reasons is because I know you've done other podcasts recently, and I would point people to those shows,
right?
Vincent Cerzullo's Comic Zone and Fanboy Radio and those interviews, because I think it's ground well covered. And I want to talk, because you've done so many other things. One thing I wanted to talk about was your Captain America run.
Well, no one has ever asked me about that.
And I loved it, and I remember it well. And it culminated, am I correct in thinking, around one of the deaths of the Red Skull. But it was such a great march, and one thing that I really appreciated, and it was probably the issue before 300, where, the Skull kind of, to give Cap his ultimate wish to make him ready for this final conflict, he gets the opportunity in his mind to go back to that day where he loses Bucky.
That's right. We also did that. I have to really send my mind back in time to even remember this. But I remember the issue that I really liked was we did a sort of a backstory on the Red Skull. We saw his backstory that had never been shown before.
Yes.
It was his whole life story from the moment he was born. And I think I worked with, was it Paul Neary drew a lot of those? I started on Captain America with Mike Zeck.
Uh-huh, yes.
Before we did Kraven's Last Hunt, that was the first thing we did together, was we did a run of Captain America together. And then Mike went off to do Secret Wars, and we got Paul Neary. And that it's funny, because that whole Captain America storyline was leading up to Captain America 300.
Right.
Which was supposed to be a double-sized issue. As if you may recall, it was not a double-sized issue when you saw it, but I wrote a double-sized issue.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
And I was building up this whole storyline, which I think in retrospect, when I look back, it was, it was like, what was it, 1984. It was a pretty outrageous idea. But my concept was that Captain America had been doing this since World War II, and we build up this final storyline where the Red Skull actually dies. Everyone that Captain America almost dies because the skull aged him, as I recall.
Yes.
And everyone that's been close to him has been jeopardized by the Red Skull, and he finally wakes up and says, "You know what? I've been punching people in the face for whatever it was, 30 years now, 40 years. I don't want to do this anymore." And he was going to throw away the shield. And the whole idea was, can a superhero exist without punching someone in the face? Is there another way to be a hero? And I worked out this whole wild storyline that was going to culminate with the Bucky of the 50s actually going nuts and assassinating Captain America. And Mark Gruenwald, who was the editor at the time, actually approved the story. And it would have been quite a story, you know, because that's something that superhero comics very rarely address. And and Keith and I address it in a tongue-in-cheek way in Hero Squared. But, you know, no matter how much we try, no matter how much philosophy and wit and wisdom we put into these stories, they always come down to two guys punching each other in the face, no matter how you cut it, you know. And it's fun, and we love the genre, and I've had so much fun with it, and it's treated me very well. But there are other ways to look at life's problems, you know? And I wanted to address that, to think about now, addressing that in a mainstream Marvel comic of the 1980s would have been slightly radical and revolutionary, and the editor-in-chief at the time, who was Jim Shooter, took one look at this and said, "Forget it. This is never happening on my watch, you know?" It was going to be, Cap was going to try to, you know, this is also the, you know, Reagan and the evil empire, that whole period.
Yes.
Cap was going to start, like, trying to put together this sort of peace movement, and the only allies he was going to find were the Submariner and Dr. Doom, and if anyone in the world, the superhero community was going to disown him. I mean, it was a wild story.
Wow.
And I give a Gruenwald credit for approving it, you know? And I've been trying to find a doorway into that story again for years, and we have a character we're introducing in the next Planetary Brigade miniseries called Fighting Man.
Okay.
Who I think is going to be my analog there, and maybe I'll get to tell that story one day.
That's cool.
But that's why if you look at Captain America 300, you'll see the story is credited to a writer named Michael Ellis, because I wrote, you know, a double-sized issue which got cut in half and completely eviscerated.
Wow.
And so I took my name off the story. You know, like I said, I look back now, and from Shooter's perspective, I can understand his point of view. At the time, I was like, offended and outraged. But now, with 20 years hindsight, it's no big deal. But it was quite a ride. So I think Gruenwald was the one who came up with the name Michael Ellis, because it came from a Monty Python routine, and they kept paging somebody named Michael Ellis, but he never showed up. So the guy who was never there, that's the name of the writer that is your Captain America.
I like a lot of your comedic influences, and I guess you're crediting that to Gruenwald, but I read that in one of your interviews, and I'm pleased to say that I share a lot of your taste for comedy. Woody Allen, The Jack Benny Show in the 40s.
It's funny, I guess it was in the late 80s, my local NPR station started playing old radio, and I always liked this stuff, but I wasn't really familiar with it, and I turned it on one night, and this brilliant comedy came on, and it was The Jack Benny Show. Now, when I was a kid, I remember Jack Benny as a sort of amiable old man.
Yes.
But it never struck me as anything brilliant or particularly, you know, outrageously funny. And you listen to these shows, and there's nothing on television now that can compare with that comedy. It's amazing. And my son, who was, you know, probably 8 years old at the time, used to listen with me, and all of a sudden I discovered, oh my God, you can buy this stuff on tape, you know? So the house filled up with Jack Benny tapes, and my son used to sit in his room, you know, 8 years old, and listen to Jack Benny all day.
Wow, that's great.
And now my daughter's been brought up on all this old radio, too, so she's in there listening to Jack Benny and George and Gracie and Dimension X and X-1
sure.
And all these great old shows. And it's an incredible art form that has been totally lost.
No, I agree with you. And even when they do try to bring back radio drama, there is something missing.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is, but yeah, I mean, you know, and well, again, you go to the Benny Show, those writers were such wonderful writers. I mean, you know, that was Milt Joseph Berg, the same guy that was writing All in the Family at its height.
And now think about that, to go from the Jack Benny radio show and and adapt so well that you can be the head writer on All in the Family. The amazing thing about the Benny Show is you hear stuff where here's a comedian on the radio using silence to get laughs.
Yes, your money or your life, absolutely.
Right. Or the idea of a gag that depends on a sound. You know,
the vault.
It can't work. And the best thing is that, you know, you're a full participant with those shows.
Yes.
You know, you close your eyes, you listen to the sound, and you create the movie in your head. You're not spoon-fed the thing. And it's a wonderful sort of give and take between the artist and the listener, you know? So I love that stuff. And I love that my daughter now, same thing. She's sitting there listening to it. And You know, I used to joke with my son when he was little, and we went to see The Jungle Book in the movies, and he was like, Cody, you're probably the only kid who came to see this movie because you knew Phil Harris was in it.
That's right. That's
my daughter
right.
did a report on Jack Benny for school a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's neat. I want to go back to another old story, and that's a Legends of the Dark Knight story you did about the Joker going sane.
My favorite superhero story that I've ever done. That's another one that sort of went under the radar, you know? And you know, DC's never collected it or anything, and maybe this conversation will intimidate them into doing it finally. But, yeah, that was another one of those stories that just, it actually, if I'm remembering correctly, it might have even grown out of my, one of my original ideas for, yeah, because the Kraven's Last Hunt thing started out as a Batman graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then that didn't happen, so I took a chunk of that idea and I went off and I did Kraven, but this idea of the villain killing the hero and then the villain thinking the hero is dead, which is what I used in Going Sane. But of course, by using the Joker there, the great thing was that once he killed Batman, his reason for existence was over. And his mind snapped. Now, we snapped. We go crazy. He snapped, and he went sane. And it becomes this incredibly touching story as he finds, you know, he finds a normal life. He finds love. And in fact, there was a whole old radio thread in there, too, because he used to sit with his girlfriend and listen to these old radio shows together.
Yes, I remember that now that you say that. Yes.
And meanwhile, Batman has another story where he's, you know, he's left for dead but is sort of washed away and found in this idyllic little town where he gets a chance to sort of divest himself of Batman and find his sanity as well. And then, of course, the moment in the end when they come back together. And Joe Staton did a wonderful job on that story.
Yes, he did.
Incredibly underrated artist who did a phenomenal job. And I'm very proud of that story. You didn't have to worry about, you know, you weren't what
yes.
was going on this month or next month or whatever, you know. I had a short run on The Adventures of Superman a few years back, and my great frustration was, and it was nobody's fault but my own, I don't hold anyone else responsible, was, you know, there was always this continuity that was coming into the book. There was, I think there might have been one issue or two issues where I wasn't dealing with some storyline that was happening in one of the other books, or it was a crossover or whatever it was, you know. And I tend to work best left to my own devices in my own little corner of the world, you know? and I did not do a good job on Adventures of Superman. It just never clicked because I was too busy having to fit all these other pieces in. It was not my best work by a long shot. It wasn't bad, you know, I have enough craft to make it a readable story. But it never clicked in that way. Whereas something like that Legends of the Dark Knight story, I just got to tell a good story.
Sure.
And that was it. And that's, you know, for me, that's nothing's better. I'd rather be writing Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade with Keith than doing that other stuff because it's our park and it's our ball and our bat and we can do whatever we want, you know.
No, I hear you. Well, and you've done the big two and done a wall.
I really have, you know. I've done all that stuff and let's be honest, Marvel's not exactly knocking down my door right now anyway. But even if they were, I don't think I could come up with another Spider-Man story. You know, I worked on Spider-Man on and off for 10 years, and I did some work, again, that I'm very, very proud of there, especially the 2 years of Spectacular Spider-Man that I did with Sal Buscema. And I've written just about every character that I could ever want to write, you know? So I don't have a lot of interest or passion in that direction. And right now, you know, with the Abadazad stuff taking up so much of my time, delightfully so, and I'm working on some movie-related projects, and the work I'm doing with Keith and finishing up Stardust Kid, I don't really want to write anybody else's characters. I've done it. It made me very, very happy. It helped me build a very nice house and take care of my family and put food on the table. But I don't particularly have a passion for it right now. And you never know. I could wake up tomorrow and go, the greatest Batman story ever told just came into my head, and I'll have to call somebody up and beg them to let me write it, you know? But I really, at the moment, I don't have an interest in it.
Well, you know, and before we leave the big two, I did want to know about your work on the Justice League Unlimited TV series, because you started with other people's stories and ended up writing the scripts. Is that a fair way to describe?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Well, the first one was they asked me to adapt Alan Moore's story for The Man Who Has Everything.
Yes.
Which, you know, if you're going to start with some raw material, that's great raw material to start with. Yeah.
You bet.
And it was really fun. You know, I did not approach that gig like, and now I'm going to make my statement about the Justice League, you know? You're part of a team. When you're working in TV, no matter, you know, unless you're the producer who created the show and is dictating to everybody else, you're part of a team. And if you go in that way, it's a lot of fun. So, you know, more often than not, the story was written by Dwayne McDuffie or Stan Berkowitz, and they hand off the story to me, and I would write the teleplay. And I had a great time. It was a tremendous amount of fun. And it's so funny, you know, because I talk about how frustrated I am by the fact that, you know, superhero stories are all about punching and hitting and throwing people through buildings, and yet I still come back to the Captain Marvel episode of Justice League Unlimited, where Captain Marvel and Superman have this incredible fight where
yes.
they basically destroy the city that Luthor's built. And so here I am, Mr. Nonviolence, and I'm going, oh, that is so cool, he just threw him through the building. And like, there's always a 12-year-old in your soul, you know, who wants to see Superman throw Captain Marvel through a building and Captain Marvel drop a statue on Superman's head. So we all contain all these things. So. But I had nothing but a great time working. I think I did 7 episodes. And Stan Berkowitz is an old buddy of mine, is phenomenal. Dwayne McDuffie is great. I mean, they were just a delight to work with. They treated me with respect. They liked my work. I respected and liked their work. So it was a dream.
Well, and the evidence, again, on the screen, they were great stories. And another one that I wanted to point to was The Return, which was kind of the Justice League as if they were the Defenders.
Right. That was the...
with Amazo?
Right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it's so funny for me because even though I wrote the Justice League with Keith for so many years, I don't like team books very much.
Okay.
I hate having to juggle characters. And so they hand me this outline with like 500 superheroes. You know? And then, you know, you got to write these scenes and you have to, oh, what are they going to do? Okay, they all have to do something clever with their powers now. And yet it turned out very nicely. Those are the kind of challenges that would come up for me. To someone else, it wouldn't be a challenge because some guys just doing that stuff is nothing to them. Oh, you know, George Perez, 500 characters, they're all using their powers in unique ways. Off he goes, you know? Not me. You know, you look at Kraven's Last Hunt, there's basically 3 characters in that story. And I focus on them, and I go down into their emotional core, and that's what I do. So some of those stories, which had lots and lots of characters and lots of action, you know, 2 things that I don't always necessarily think I do all that well, it was a challenge, and it was a lot of fun. But they always gave me rock-solid stories to work from. And I was always amazed at how much story, even though, you know, probably half the cartoon ended up with punching and hitting by the time they were done, but there was always a lot of story and there was always a lot of character going on.
Absolutely.
In the context of a 22-minute cartoon.
Yeah, and I was wondering how much of that was your framing and how much of it was the story that you were handed in the case of the Justice League specifically.
In terms of the balance between the action and the character and everything?
Yeah.
Well, one thing that I saw right away from the Superman, the Alan Moore story, was that I'd write a little fight sequence, and it would maybe be a page and a half in the script. And then I'd watch the show, and it'd be like, oh, my God, they're still hitting each other. It's been 15 minutes. Because you know? I guess the directors, they're, you know, they get it, and they're having fun figuring out, you know, great ways to choreograph these big fight scenes. You know?
Sure, sure.
But, you know, the whole thing was really, it was a collaboration. So, you know, and it's sort of like when I work with Keith, and there are so many things in our stories together that Keith thinks I came up with it, and I think he came up with it. And,
yes.
And that's the fun of it, because we sort of blend into one. And working on these shows, so I'd get a great Stan Berkowitz story or a Dwayne McDuffie story, and I would try to add my stuff to it. And by the time the show comes on, I'll have to go back to the script sometime and go, well, was that my line? Was that Dwayne's outline? Did that? Or, you know, then, of course, you have to realize it's television, so there's always someone that does a final rewrite on these things when it's out of your hand. So it's this blend, and I'm always happy when a lot of my words get into the episode.
Oh, sure.
Well, because it was great. You know, you couldn't ask for anything more than to work with good people and on a show like that, which everyone enjoys and respects.
And I wondered also about the Steranko episode, the Mr. Miracle episode.
That was another one that was great fun because I am a Jack Kirby fanatic.
That's cool.
And those New Gods, Mr. Miracle, Forever People, all those comics.
Yep.
Are some of my favorite comic books of all time.
That's cool.
You know, so I had an incredible time with that. And then the best part was, you know, who they had for the voices.
Yeah, Artie Johnson.
Edward Asner, right, Artie Johnson from Laugh-In. Edward Asner from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. What's his name? Michael Dorn that does Worf.
Yes, Kalibak, yes.
Talk about a pop culture collision, you know what I mean?
Oh, you bet it. I had Dwayne McDuffie on, and I think you couldn't find better casting for Granny Goodness than Edward Asner. And
it was unbelievable.
And it was driving me crazy. I'm like, who is that? And then finally I realized, oh, my God, it's Ed Asner.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It was incredible. So, I mean, you know, to be a part of that show and then have each of these guys who each in turn was part of a television history in some way, and they all were, you know.
Certainly.
Dorn with Star Trek and then Laugh-In and Mary Tyler Moore. And they're in a superhero cartoon, for God's sake, you know? It's very funny, and it was great fun. But to play with those Kirby characters was just wonderful.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your music to wrap up, because okay. Do you have a new CD out? Or are you re-releasing stuff that
I'm
you
I'm re-releasing. There's a CD that I did in the late 90s. And I did it really, I didn't do it to become a rock and roll star. You know, I played in bands when I was in my teens and 20s. And then at some point I made a very conscious decision not to play music for a living anymore because I think the road would have killed me. I would end up a drug addict laying in a bathroom somewhere like Elvis, you know?
I gotcha.
So I opted for a much more quiet life, writing nice stories. But music has remained a part of my life, and in the late 90s, really, just for the sheer joy of it, I did a CD called How Many Lifetimes, and it's been out of the mainstream for a while, and I decided it was time to bring it back, because people just over the years, a lot of people ask me about it. I'm not doing this to make a lot of money or anything, you know,
sure,
because I'm not going to, which is a good reason not to want to do that. And I just got it up on iTunes.
Cool.
So if anyone wants to sample the songs or download the CD, it's there on iTunes. And I'm as proud of this CD as I am of any creative endeavor in my entire career. And I had the great joy of working on it was that, you know, I'm used to writing for a deadline or writing for print because, you know, there's an editor, there's an audience, there's all this stuff that's sort of waiting out there. This was creating for the sheer joy of the creation.
Very cool.
With nothing, I wasn't thinking about what was going to happen with it after the fact, you know. So it was some of the most fun I've ever had in my entire life. So it's out there again. It's on iTunes, or you could go to cdbaby.com if you want to buy an actual physical CD, which are fast becoming dinosaurs. You know?
Yes.
And so I just want to share the music, you know, and I'm hoping sometime soon. It's been, I guess, almost 10 years, so I would like to get back into the studio. I have so many more songs to record and get another one out there.
That's cool. I love Baba Rain, man. I thought that was a really neat song, and I think I saw that on Comic Book Resources, and
yeah.
I know I emailed you about it and told you how much I liked it. You sent me another one as well, and with your permission, we'll have them on the page with the interview as well.
Oh, that'd be great.
Very cool.
I just want to share the music at this point. Like I said, I'm not looking to make a fortune, or even $5, probably.
Well, congratulations, man. Honestly, I wish you a lot of luck with the Bodhisattva, and again, I think you really found the right format for it, because, you know, maybe the comic book isn't the right place anymore for kids, just because of the price point. Just, you know, it was easier when we were kids and there were 12 cents or, you know, even I, you know, remember the 20 cent ones mostly. That's what I was spending.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was easier when you had a quarter and you could buy two comic books as opposed to now, you know, a kid with 10 bucks, all right, he's got three comic books. I don't know.
Or, you know, forget that. You know, my daughter's 11 years old. She gets $2.50 a week in allowance.
There you go.
What is she, you know, if she was in love with comics, what is she going to buy? Can she buy one for $2.50? And if she can, she can only buy one. I'm old enough that I remember, I was young, but I remember when they were 10 cents. I
sure.
remember the day they went from 10 to 12 cents, and my mother was appalled. How could they charge that for a comic book, you know? But I had a friend who was going into the hospital to have a mole removed or some little simple operation, and his mother gave him a buck, and he bought 10 comic books. And I was so jealous, I could have killed him. Can you imagine, you know, 10
sure.
comic books for a dollar?
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. And I remember having a 50-cent allowance, and yeah, being able to go down and buy, you know, at least two a week, and still
yeah.
have enough for a pack of bubble, you know, baseball cards
yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly. So I think I hadn't thought about that, but it's true. You know, what kid is going to want to blow his whole allowance on a couple of comic books?
Right. So I mean, it's like I said. I think this is great, and I'm glad you found the right format for parents to be attracted by the Mike Plug look. And I think once they read the stories as well, I think you're going to have them. So.
Yeah, we're both Mike and I are totally over the moon about this, and we're so excited. So, everyone listening must run to your local Barnes & Noble and buy multiple copies. And the fun is that the first two books are coming out simultaneously because they wanted to make a presence so that people know it's a series. It's not just one random book. So you can get the first two books, and they're priced at like $9.99, so they're very affordable.
That's
and
true.
When you see the package that you get for $9.99, how beautiful these books look, just as a work of art to look at. Forget the story. It's worth every penny.
We'll remember the story. But I hear you. Now, Jan, that's great, man, and I appreciate your time today, and good luck with the project.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.
Interesting stuff from J.M. DeMatteis. Make sure you check out Abadazad. The first two volumes are out from Hyperion Books and available at bookstores and online. Do yourself a favor, too, and check out the Abadazad website, abadazad.com. for a fully animated teaser and lots of information on what the story is all about. The Stardust Kid, Planetary Brigade, and Hero Squared from Boom Studios. And check out Jam's music as well at iTunes, or you can download the songs featured on his page right here at the WordBalloon.com website. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to Word Balloon for updates on more episodes. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.